Welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl, and my guest today is Gabriela Coleman from New York.
Thanks for having me.
Hi. Yeah, you are an anthropologist. Is it correctly
pronounced? That is correct. Anthropologist.
Yeah, and you are working on hackers.
I've worked on different hacker communities and different forms of kind of geek and hacker politics. Free software, open source, anonymous have been my main areas of expertise.
And when did you start exploring it?
Slightly more informally in 1998 with free software, and then full force in 2001 with a focus on Debian and a few other legal developments in free software. And then in 2008, I also started to do some work on Anonymous as well.
Which is now a very high topic.
That's right. It really exploded this year, very surprisingly, and has then required me to do very intensive work for the last 8-9 months.
You're writing a book, or have you finished it?
I am currently finishing the book on free software. I should be turning it in about 2 to 3 weeks. Three, because I'm here. Otherwise, it would have been 2 weeks. And I'm then currently just starting to write the book on Anonymous, publishing some short pieces in the meantime, and hopefully go full force with that in a couple of months.
And you're working at the university.
I'm working at the university. I teach at New York University, where I'm also able to teach a class on the anthropology of hackers as well, which is really quite wonderful.
Oh, it's something I think we don't really have it in Germany, that anthropologists are exploring hacker communities.
No, I mean, it's a little bit unusual for anthropologists to work in the area of technology. Not entirely. There's obviously some who do. But it's even more unusual to do the anthropology of technology in Europe and North America. Anthropologists will often tend to work in a different area of the world. So I'm still a little bit of an odd duck, as they say, in my discipline.
Yeah, but that's cool.
Yeah, I like being the odd duck. And ducks are great.
Yeah, and so let's start with Anonymous. What is Anonymous? Can you explain it in some sentence to, how would you describe your parents what Anonymous is?
I think I would describe by saying that currently Anonymous is a political movement with many different heads or faces or nodes. But one of the curious things about Anonymous, which is currently engaged in many different political operations, often online, and we should talk a little bit more about what they look like and feel like, their roots aren't quite in politics. And that's kind of a weird thing about Anonymous, is that they came out of an image board called 4chan, which is home to many discussions. And it's also home to what's called trolling, where the people participating on 4chan, who are all anonymous, might pick a target and humiliate them, order pizzas, and these sorts of things, some of which are lighthearted and others which are much darker. And for many years, the name Anonymous was used to coordinate trolling. And then at a certain point in 2008, when people were using the name Anonymous to troll the Church of Scientology, there was a shift. And the shift was one that put some quarters of Anonymous into political territory. So some started to protest the church using more traditional tactics. And yet the name was still used to troll at the same time. So this was a period of time where Anonymous grew different heads. I like to describe it as a hydra. I don't know what that is in German.
Yeah, we have also hydra.
Hydra. So, you know, it's very much a hydra where there's different heads, some of which are political, some of which are not, and different networks and places where Anonymous is found. But over the last 8 months especially, more and more of these heads have become political, although sometimes in quite transgressive ways as well.
Okay. And Normally, if you see pictures, you see people wearing a mask. Why did they choose the Guy Fawkes? Mask.
I mean, I think that there was a couple things going on, but the Guy Fawkes mask, which was made very popular with a movie, V for Vendetta, which they draw some kind of iconography and inspiration from, was also the mask was a sort of obscure meme on 4chan. And a meme is a kind of image or joke or catchphrase which has a propensity to travel and also transform. But when the participants were organizing the first street protest against the Church of Scientology in February 2008, someone had the great idea to use the mask, which already they used to kind of identify Anonymous, to actually protect people from the Church of Scientology, who's very, very famous for going for finding their critics and taking pictures of them and possibly harassing them. So someone had the great idea of, hey, everyone, show up with a mask at the protest on February 10th of 2008. And all of a sudden, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, it was really thousands of people started to order the mask. And indeed, they showed up to the protests wearing them, which was an ingenious move. And then all of a sudden, that's really when the Guy Fawkes mask stuck. It wasn't the first time that it was associated with Anonymous, but that was the time where that icon became almost synonymous or sort of a signature for Anonymous.
It was transported over mainstream media.
Absolutely. And it was just, there were so many pictures circulating at the time. And you know, obviously it's not the only image or icon that's associated with Anonymous. Another one is a headless suit as well. And it too proves a certain point where the individual behind the mask or the face doesn't matter. It's the anonymity that matters to this movement.
Yeah, when we see the roots at 4chan, why was Scientology the first target in 2008? That they started becoming political?
That started becoming political. Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of ways of looking at it. One of which is, first they targeted the church for the lulls, for the jokes, for pranking. But there's a way in which Scientology is such a compelling target at some level because it's almost this perfect nemesis for many geeks and hackers, just because it's a religion of science and technology, and yet the technology doesn't work, the science is not considered real, it's a very proprietary organization. And so it kind of looks and feels like some of the values that geeks and hackers hold, but upside down, inverted. And so it's a little bit like a moth that's attracted to light, in part because it's this perfect nemesis. But one thing that's interesting, too, and which did happen historically and sociologically, is that there had been a previous era where some geeks and hackers and net enthusiasts and First Amendment loyalists had protested the church quite vigorously in the 1990s. And there were many different campaigns, but one important node was Usenet, where there was a news group that was quite critical of the church, or people were critical of the church. And there was these big wars. There was lawsuits and raids and obviously, it wasn't only geeks and hackers involved, but some were involved. And so when Anonymous started to troll the church, some of the old-time critics, people who had participated quite heavily and who continued to criticize the church, said, guys, what you're doing is sort of wonderful, but can you tone down the kind of craziness and really look at some of these issues? And that message did then get some people Anonymous rethinking what they did. So that's one line. The other thing which happened was the protests, the street protests. Many people showed up just to meet other people from 4chan because it would be fun. But I think the very activity of street protest transforms people. And they saw indeed what could happen, how you can get media attention, how you could bring light to an issue. And they liked what they experienced and saw, and they were politically transformed. So I think those two elements came together with this campaign, which hadn't happened before, to create a new political possibility within Anonymous.
And there was the Tom Cruise interview.
That's right. The question there is, why did Anonymous even notice the Church of Scientology? Why did they even troll? And that was fascinating, because there was a video that was internal to the church. It was never meant for public consumption, and it was of Tom Cruise, who's a member of the Church of Scientology. And the video was of him explaining why the church was so important. He was extremely enthusiastic. And someone leaked the video. And Scientology then was going to sue certain websites if they didn't take down the video. And that's when Anonymous is like, oh, yeah, you're going to censor what we can do on the internets? Ha, 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 no way. And that's when they started to troll and raid. They would prank call the Dianetics hotline. They ordered pizzas to the church. They would fax their butts and send in the faxes, right? And that lasted for a little while before the protests were planned. And then once the protests really happened, then it became more traditional, although the playful, unpredictable elements of Anonymous, which we'll call the lulls, never entirely went away.
Okay. And so Scientology, it's a campaign. How long did it last?
It's still ongoing. And that's important to note, because some people think that Anonymous went from point A to point B, point B being the protests against the Movie Player Association, against PayPal. But in fact, the protests against the Church of Scientology are still ongoing right now in many cities across North America and Europe. They're definitely smaller. It's not quite as big as it used to be, in part because I think for many they were successful. You could now be openly critical of the church in a way that you couldn't really be before Anonymous. So they've really, really brought a lot of attention that didn't exist before. They do meet in person because they have street protests, but different nodes in Anonymous do not necessarily meet in person like that node does.
Okay. And what happens between the big protests against Scientology in 2008 and then in 2010 with the movies, movie industry, what you can explain later?
Sure. So there were ongoing protests, and there was also a few other operations that were small. I'm not going to go into all of them. I will mention, for example, that Anonymous contributed to some protests and support in 2009 when the Iranian, you know, quote-unquote revolution happened. It was not exactly successful. But you could see how participants in Anonymous, or using the name Anonymous, were diversifying between 2008 and September 2010. But there were small little operations. And then in September of 2010, something else happened, which is the Motion Picture Association of America hired an Indian software firm to do a DDoS, a distributed denial of service attack, against the Pirate Bay. And all of a sudden, another wave, a distinct arm, came into being, political arm. And it first kind of emerged out of 4chan again. And what they did, using the name Anonymous, was they did DDoS attacks against the Motion Player Association of America, as well as some other organizations in protest of what they had done against the Pirate Bay. And this was Operation Payback. And all of a sudden, and this was a surprise to me, I just didn't expect a different node to emerge. And it was quite dramatic, the attacks, but it didn't really go in terms of public in terms of the sort of media that was being focused on this. It was mainly reported in technology news sections of the newspaper and online. So it was a big deal, but it was still not really known outside of tech circles. So then in December of 2010, that arm of Anonymous all of a sudden really, really became quite famous or infamous when they started to lead a campaign in support of WikiLeaks after PayPal, MasterCard, and Amazon pulled services to process donations, for example, in the case of PayPal and MasterCard, and in terms of Amazon, they were hosting WikiLeaks. They pulled their services due to kind of extra legal pressure because of the cables that WikiLeaks had released. And this really hit the mainstream news, in part because of the size of the DDoS campaign was huge.
And WikiLeaks was huge.
And WikiLeaks was huge, and that's what everyone was focused on at the time, right? And so this was quite an interesting moment. Also interesting for Anonymous because they themselves didn't quite organize this campaign in a very premeditated manner. Someone had kind of thrown the idea online and it was a little bit of a side project. And yet once they started to sort of advertise it, which is what they do on Twitter and 4chan, the numbers just started showing up. They also had a lot of bots in the IRC channel that looked like they were human. So it was a little, you didn't really know how many people were online, but it was quite large. And they themselves were a little bit surprised, overwhelmed by the amount of interest and support in this particular operation.
And in this operation, there was used a software called Loic. Did someone coded it before? Was it available and it, just used?
Yeah, or? I believe it was definitely available before. And I don't know the exact time it had been coded, but it was absolutely available. And in fact, you know, prior to this, they had done a number of different DDoS campaigns, right? And one of the reasons why they were able to have them be so big was that an individual could download the software and contribute. They also had some access to botnets to do some of the DDoSing as well. But they became quite famous for helping to provide the software, the low-orbit ion cannon, that then allowed individuals to kind of contribute. Some probably knowing of the legal risks that they were putting themselves in, and others probably unaware of the legal risks that they were putting themselves into at the time.
Yeah, I know several people who, for them, it was fun, and they downloaded the software, and I told them, okay, maybe you have to check your IP addresses, and they didn't care about it, and they didn't knew the law. And
right, and now there have been arrests, and obviously since that time, I think that there is a new kind of awareness of the risks, and there's also a lot of debate. Is this a legitimate tactic to use politically? And there is a debate because it is controversial. You know, there are many compelling arguments, I would say, on both sides.
Can you give some examples on the both arguments?
Sure. So one argument against them, or let's look at two arguments against them, one of which is from a civil liberties perspective and one's just from a pragmatic perspective. From a civil liberties perspective, some people will argue that the DDoS is a form of censorship because websites are a place where communication happens. And so if you take down a website, you are infringing on an individual or a corporation's right to speak. So it's a kind of free speech argument. On a more practical level, someone might say, look, it isn't really that, for reasons I will get into in a moment. But you know what? It's silly, juvenile, and ineffective. And here I'll personally intervene and say, I actually do think it's ineffective if it's overused. Absolutely. You cannot just DDoS, 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 and then draw the attention you need. So if one does think it's politically worthwhile, it only is worthwhile insofar as it's used infrequently. So those are two arguments against, which again I do think are very compelling. Two arguments for are that it's more akin to a blockade because the services aren't taken down permanently or even for a long time. And I think that's true only if you are DDoSing a company or government with a lot of resources. Some small human rights organizations have been taken down for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and indeed it is a form of silencing for them. So it could be kind of contextual. You could also say it is a form of free speech silencing in some cases and not in others. I do think that given the resources of MasterCard and PayPal and the fact that Amazon couldn't even be taken down, people proposed it and they're like, come on, guys, we just don't have the resources for it. In that context, I didn't see it as a silencing of speech, but I can see why it absolutely is in many cases. The other element is very interesting, especially in this day and age where it's very hard to get sustained media attention for all sorts of reasons, one of which is because there's a proliferation of media outlets, which has its benefits and downsides. And a very dramatic campaign can certainly get media attention to publicize an issue. And the 2010 December campaign probably succeeded along those lines. Now, one of the difficult things, of course, is this question of, is it civil disobedience? I think the campaign could probably be accurately described as a form of direct action, in the sense that people didn't wait for others to make a judgment. They just took action that day. That is, I don't think, really in dispute. Traditionally, many forms of civil disobedience have been carried out by very small groups who provide a lot of training as to what's going to happen, how to proceed, what happens when people are arrested. They have their lawyers already. This did not happen, of course, with Anonymous, right, which was much more populist and spontaneous. Does that make it not civil disobedience, or does that just problematize our theories of civil disobedience?
Okay, and would you agree that civil disobedience with a botnet is a correct thing or not? So it's a different if you use a Loic software on your own computer, or right, if you have lots of big botnets with Trojans on lots of computers and just press a button.
I think if you are making a legal argument, it is much, 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 much easier to make the argument that civil disobedience, when it's all just individuals who consciously are in control of their actions and the software they are using, right? And that's the much more, it's the argument that could ring true to courts, right? Because so much of civil disobedience has always been about an individual's action. And of course, botnets complicate that for all sorts of reasons. Everything from the fact that some botnets are based on infecting people's computers and they have even no idea that that's happening. To the fact that then one person is in command of a massive tool. But that's where it's a kind of interesting question, because some botnets, there still must be an individual behind that botnet, right, to some degree. So it's just, I guess, you know, one difference is that you could imagine that the individual with Loic has a small hammer and then the person with the botnet has a chainsaw or something, you know? But I think when you're going to courts, the image of the person with the hammer is going to be much more more compelling and understandable than the person with a chainsaw, I think.
Mm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. What was debated yesterday here at the Chaos Communication Camp when it comes to hacker ethics.
Right.
Because of... So more or less the German CCC or the European hacker community, they said, okay, it's not the best way to use this. Right. We had this debate 10 years before or 12 years before with, I don't know, the hacker group.
Electronic Disturbance Theater, perhaps?
Yeah, one thing, and there was another hacker group who did...
eToy also did some. eToy and EDT, and then there was the campaign against Lufthansa here in Germany.
Yeah, Libertad.
Which was also a very interesting campaign, very executed very differently from Anonymous, where I even found out yesterday that they contacted the police and said, we're going to be taking down this website.
That's right, Germans. So.
Yeah. I was like, how civil of them. And it's true. I mean, each one has its benefits and downsides. There is something about the 2010 campaign, which I believe it's not simply, oh, we've already debated this. I think that there was really something new about it. Not entirely, but the fact that it happened in the course of 24 hours and clearly kind of, you know, touched a nerve of sorts is something that really has to be addressed. And yet there is, and this was in the talk, and I think one of the best parts about the talk is, can you, on the one hand, perhaps not fully support it because you think it's not a useful tactic, but still have solidarity for those that have now been arrested for these events, right? Or do you not show solidarity as a way to critique the very tactic, too? And that's a question that was raised during the talk, and I don't think, you know, we've fully answered it either.
Okay, and so DDoS attack is one thing of strategy used by Anonymous since 1 year, and sometimes we thought about every day there was a new Anonymous video and declaring war on the next corporation, something like that, and we thought, hey, let's wear our Guy Fawkes masks and do a video and we will come into mainstream media with, oh, we are declaring war on the Pope or something else. How is it working? How are the structures that one video will get lots of attention and lots of other 15-year-old people who are doing their videos will not get the attention?
Okay, yeah. I will say that one person trying to follow a Hydra is probably not a very good model for research because there are many things going on simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there are less things going on at once. But one of the curious things about some of the videos, let's just focus in on that for one moment, is that sometimes some of them have been released just by one individual who literally, you know, decides to make something. And whether or not it catches is very, very hard to predict, you know. It's about who retweets it, who spreads it around. It's got to be good. You know, there are some pretty crappy ones out there. But there is also, on one of the networks, there still is an operation. It's not quite as active as it was. It is called Propaganda. And there was a group of people who collaborated to make manifestos, images, and videos, right? And some of these were also very popular because they were done with a lot of thought put into them. And I mention that because it is important to know, which is sometimes missed, that even while, for example, Anonymous was still doing some DDoS campaigns in Tunisia, let's just say, they also were doing four or five different operations, some of which were just providing technological assistance, for instance, similar to what Telecomix was doing and often drawing on the work of Telecomix to do it. They were also helping to gopher videos out of Tunisia. And so at one moment, there are four or five, sometimes more, sometimes less operations going. And I would say, with the exception of the hacking operations, which have been kind of recent to Anonymous's history, many of the operations work in such a way where there's ad hoc leaders, people who definitely have put in more work, who become operators on the IRC channels, who carry more influence in certain respects. And yet, the conversations tend to happen very openly, too. And one of the interesting things is that this fragmentation, where there's four or five different operations, just means that while there are nodes of authority or power, the fragmentation means it never pools very strongly in one place. Now, the hacking operations are a little different.
Yeah, we come to this later, but you mentioned a good point. So it's more or less some kind of reputation system, as we know from the open source communities, how Anonymous works.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, perhaps one of the differences is that sometimes you don't know who the person is behind the nickname. Whereas in open source, you tend to know, oh, that person also works here, and, you know, is this person. And so oftentimes the reputation accrues just around this name in some ways. And that's a little bit different in terms of some of the dynamics than open source. But definitely, just like in many geek or hacker communities, there is a kind of duocracy, meritocracy at play. Now, for newcomers, especially newcomers who are not well-versed in IRC conventions or hanging out and interacting with geeks and hackers, I think it can be a little bit confusing. What's going on? If you have cultural knowledge, you stand a better chance of moving ahead. And obviously, if you're able to contribute, like, are you able to make a flyer or contribute to the manifesto or contribute technically? These are the ways in which then you're kind of recognized in some way.
How important is pop culture when it comes to the Guy Fawkes masks, the suit without face, and all the videos? Is it a very important thing to reach out and get more supporters?
I think they're definitely extremely PR savvy. I think that they're surprised that they're PR savvy, but they are PR savvy, you know. And that can, you know, when by using PR savvy, it also means a lot of people don't like them too, right? But they definitely get the attention of people. And in part, I think they do so because some of their videos have been extremely compelling. There's something about them, you know.
It says they are emotional.
They're emotional, exactly, in the music, and they mix in bits from movies as well. Some of them are just really, really, really well done. And I think that has been very important to their success. I think without that, without those images and manifestos, I don't think that they would have had the same sort of notoriety that they command.
Okay, and so the latest operations, they were more into Lulzsec. Why did some people started within the Anonymous movement to say, okay, let's hack companies and servers and release it?
Right. So I think this is also complicated. Part of the story I actually don't fully know yet. So whoever's listening, you know, take this as a kind of preliminary thoughts. I do think that there was something about the HB Gary hack which opened up some possibilities. The HB Gary hack happened after a security researcher by the name of Aaron Barr made it public that he was going to turn into the FBI some of the quote-unquote real names of alleged participants. He had claimed he had infiltrated. And a few number of participants decided to take sort of immediate action. They felt that that was a threat, and they also wanted to teach him a lesson. And so they basically hacked into the company he worked for. They used some social engineering, some other tactics. They gutted many of the servers. They deleted backups. They deleted the data in his iPad, iPhone, and then they humiliated him. They downloaded his emails. They put them all online. But what happened? They found some very damning, interesting information in the emails from the company. Without going into massive details, basically the company was proposing to act as agent provocateurs to discredit and delegitimate WikiLeaks and journalists who supported them. And I think this in some ways consciously, unconsciously kind of opened up a possibility where certain hackers who participate in Anonymous, because again, it's not all hackers, decided to move forward with more hacking operations. But at first, they did it under the banner of LulzSec, not Anonymous. And in fact, I am bracketing, you know, the hacking part, but the one thing that it was an unbelievable 50-day sprint of activity in which there were so many actions. Some journalists have told me that they couldn't even cover it because most campaigns or events usually have a 3-day news cycle, they say, and then this one was like one day after the next, after the next, after the next. And in that way, it was kind of extraordinary. And I think LulzSec themselves didn't know what was possible. Once they retired, some participants started an operation by the name of AntiSec and Anonymous, and they continued the hacking, although much of it more politically motivated, although using some of the very disruptive, unpredictable tactics that LulzSec deployed as well.
Which are?
Releasing social security numbers, for example, of police officers. They do sometimes definitely redact information. They haven't released everything always. But they definitely release some data in such a way that some people would say that there is a potential for collateral damage. All the while also sometimes releasing some interesting data dumps as well about, for example, the cybersecurity industrial complex. Probably, you know, in comparison to the DDoS, the hacks look far more dicey. And interestingly enough, as an anthropologist, part of my role is not really to lay a judgment on them. And I don't quite have one. I find them some levels compelling and very disturbing. But I have talked to a lot of people, and I've been surprised at sometimes very strong support from people that I don't expect. And, of course, a lot of condemnation as well, not necessarily for the data dumps, but some of the information that's included in them.
And what do you think is coming next? So there's a new kind of social movement which has no real structures or is not really organized as we know it from the past environmental movement and stuff like that. Will this be sustainable? Will there be more structures except of IRC channels or Twitter accounts?
It's a question that is on really the forefront of my mind, in part because I've seen so many digital entities that are very ad hoc and pretty loosely organized have to organize over time. Free software is a perfect example of this. Small projects, once they hit a certain number of people, they don't become, you know, administrative or anything, but they do develop policies and norms, and they do
create a foundation.
Yes, they do institutionalize to survive. So what's going to happen with Anonymous? And it's interesting, here at the CCC camp, Telecomics declared their own retirement, at least for a time being, yesterday, in part from burnout. And interestingly enough, I think Telecomics and Anonymous have been in a very similar situation where they've been going nonstop. But there's a couple of differences, one of which is one thing with Anonymous is that one network can sort of go away or get smaller, and another network can grow. And so you can solve the burnout problem that way. One can die and then another one's born. And there are some new networks that are kind of bubbling right now. And so we'll see if that goes anywhere. Then I think there's also the interesting question of the hacking operations, which have gotten so much media attention because the media, you know, they love to cover hackers and hacking, and everything that even is remotely close to hacking becomes a hacking scandal. And so in some ways, what's interesting about this moment is that there's been so much focus on the hacking operations. The question I think I'm looking at is whether Anonymous is going to become known primarily for that, or whether attention is going to be moved to some other ongoing operations, which have actually been ongoing, not quite as large as before. So this is it feels like a real kind of transition moment at some level for the future, at least of one network within Anonymous.
So it will be interesting in the future too.
Absolutely, to be determined.
Okay, I have no more questions.
Okay, great.
We reached 40 minutes, and that's a good time for a podcast.
Definitely. Okay.
Then, well, thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
And have fun at the camp.
Oh, I've had a wonderful time.